Our brains have allowed humans to navigate some of the most difficult times in our history. Famine, drought, and uncertainty. And because the human brain was shaped by those times, it also finds itself at the center of some of the most difficult health problems that we have today. This is an episode about how some of the most important changes in obesity are entirely invisible, and they start in the brain. The most time-enduring model of weight loss and weight gain is the energy balance model. Calories in, calories out. There is overwhelming evidence to support this model, and yet it's not the end of the story, because it's the brain that controls calories in and calories out. What has some scientists concerned is that many of the changes occurring in the brain in obesity tend to resemble those patterns that we see in brain injury, possibly making it even more difficult to lose weight. We'll talk about those changes, how they occur, how potentially to avoid them, and what we know so far about starting to reverse them. In 1997, scientists at Cambridge University identified a pair of cousins who were suffering from extreme weight gain and fat accumulation, placing them in the 99th percentile for weight, despite having normal heights for their age. The older of the cousins, an 8-year-old girl, was normal at birth, but after a few months developed an appetite that was literally insatiable. The girl began to eat and eat, voraciously, constantly demanding more and more food. Her appetite was never satisfied, and when a meal was done, she would immediately ask for another, and even after that, she would resort to hiding food to eat later, in secret. As the girl grew, her weight and fat mass skyrocketed. The girl's legs deformed under the weight of her body, requiring corrective surgery, and at age 6, she even had to undergo liposuction to try to improve the mobility of her thighs. By age 9, the girl already weighed 209 pounds, placing her in the 99th percentile for weight for her age. At 59% body fat, this girl was truly suffering, and things were beginning to look hopeless. And then, the cousins underwent genetic testing. The scientists at Cambridge discovered that both of the cousins had a mutation in a gene that coded for a protein called leptin, making them unable to produce that hormone. Leptin is a hormone that is produced by fat cells, and under normal circumstances, its job is to communicate to the brain information regarding how much fat stores are on a person's body. But the cousins' fat cells were unable to produce this hormone, and as a result, their brains thought that they were starving. The consequence of this was extreme amounts of eating and extraordinary levels of fat accumulation. But thanks to the work done by scientists over the last 150 years, there may have been a cure already available just around the corner for the cousins. When she was 9 years old, the older girl cousin started undergoing leptin therapy to try to restore her leptin levels to normal. Almost instantaneously, the rapid weight gain that had characterized her entire life reversed, and drastically. Month over month, the girl's weight dropped effortlessly, and after 12 months, she'd already lost 36 pounds. That's over 17% of her body weight. And what's more, almost all of this weight loss came from fat mass, sparing her lean tissues. After several months, the girl's mobility began to be restored, and she became at least as physically active as her peers. She no longer demanded food between meals, and she no longer had to hide food to eat later in secret. Because of the work of these scientists, this girl's life, and soon that of her cousin, were saved from their genetic fates. But this wasn't an accident. How did the scientists at Cambridge know to look for a mutation in the gene that coded for leptin? To understand this, we have to understand how leptin acts in the brain and the body, and first, the experiments that started it all. 1840. An anatomist by the name of Bernard Moore described a rare case of extreme fat accumulation in a 47-year-old female who later died and was found to have a large tumor pressing near an area of the brain called the hypothalamus. Over the next 60 years, a series of cases emerged in the science literature describing tumors near the hypothalamus and extreme weight accumulation. And in 1901, a scientist by the name of Frohlich became famous for publishing a manuscript describing the possible connection between the hypothalamus, its neighbors, and extreme obesity. What Frohlich likely did not know at the time was that a much more famous professor, Babinski, had already beat him to it a year earlier. These two back-to-back reports sparked a flurry of interest in scientific experimentation to try to understand the relationship between the hypothalamus, its surrounding structures, and weight gain. We talked about the hypothalamus. So what is the hypothalamus and why is it so important? Well, the hypothalamus is critically important for just about every organ system involved in staying alive. Located deep within the skull at the base of the brain, the hypothalamus is only about 0.4% of the brain volume, so very small, about the size of a marble. It serves a huge range of physiologic functions. It controls our energy expenditure by telling the thyroid whether to go up or down. It controls our thermoregulation or our temperature regulation. It controls appetite, thirst, reproductive functions, and responses to stress. And we now know that the hypothalamus is critically important for body fat regulation as well. We know that some of the most important genes associated with obesity are expressed highly in the central nervous system, and in particular, in the hypothalamus. And it's for this reason that many of our drug discovery programs and our drugs being developed to target obesity are looking at sites in the hypothalamus. But in the early 1900s, this wasn't so obvious. So in 1943, a neuroanatomist at Yale by the name of John Brobeck had the idea that it was in fact damage to the hypothalamus rather than its neighbors that was the real cause of obesity in these cases. In a series of experiments, Brobeck surgically lesioned a part of the hypothalamus known as the ventromedial hypothalamus in rats. Now, ventromedial may sound like an intimidating term, but all it means is that this part of the hypothalamus was towards the middle of the body, and ventral means that this part of the hypothalamus was towards the front of the animal, or in rats, more specifically, towards the floor. Even before the anesthesia had fully worn off, the animals started frantically roaming about their cages, looking for food, demonstrating what we would call foraging behavior. When Brobeck placed food in the cages, the animals started frantically stuffing as much food as they possibly could into their mouths. So fast, in fact, that many of them even had airway problems from food particles flying into their lungs. The rats started eating 2 or 3 times the amount of a normal rodent per day. And by the end of the experiment, the rats were extraordinarily obese. Brobeck's research was confirmed in future studies. And future studies also showed that if instead of damaging the ventromedial hypothalamus, if that area was stimulated chronically, that this would result in leaner animals gaining less weight throughout their lifetimes. So by the end of the 1940s, it was abundantly clear that the hypothalamus was critically involved in appetite regulation and perhaps in body fat regulation. What scientists still didn't know was what exactly the hypothalamus was doing. What was it sensing in the body? What signals was it receiving? And how, importantly, was it affecting downstream pathways to adjust appetite and energy expenditure? Many of our most important discoveries happen as a stroke of luck. And that's exactly what happened 6 years after Brobeck's initial experiments at the Jackson Memorial Lab in Bar Harbor, Maine, where scientists discovered a group of mice who were extremely obese. Based on their inheritance patterns, the researchers concluded that the mice carried a genetically recessive gene mutation that they termed OB. Almost impossible to know at the time, these mice held the keys to a cure for the cousins some 50 years later at Cambridge. Recessive mutations often result in the body being unable to produce a certain protein or product, much like the leptin-deficient cousins that we mentioned at the beginning of our story. Some years went by before scientists understood what the OB gene was. But in 1973, a researcher by the name of Douglas Coleman had the idea that the obese mutant mice may have lacked a certain circulating hormone or signal to keep their appetites at bay. He termed this hormone the satiety factor, satiety meaning full. Coleman had the idea that if in fact the genetically obese mice lacked the satiety factor, that if he connected their blood supplies with that of a normal mouse, that the satiety factor would flow over from the normal mouse and into the bloodstream of the genetically obese mice, restoring their appetites and normalizing their weights. And in fact, this is exactly what happened. In a procedure known as parabiosis, Coleman connected the blood supplies of a genetically obese mouse with that of a normal mouse. And the result was that the genetically obese mouse lost weight and its appetite normalized. This confirmed that in fact the satiety factor was real, and these experiments set off a grueling scientific arms race to try to isolate and clone the OB gene, the gene responsible for the production of the satiety factor. After many years of painstaking, grueling work, scientists finally isolated and cloned the OB gene. And the scientists often credited for its discovery, Jeffrey Friedman, termed the product of the OB gene leptin, after the Greek word leptos, meaning thin. Leptin made it possible for the 9-year-old girl in the beginning of our story to live a normal life. It also generated massive interest from the pharmaceutical industry, because it finally looked like we had discovered a drug that could help ordinary people to lose weight. But as clinical trials rolled in, we discovered that leptin wasn't the silver bullet that we thought it would be. Leptin didn't reliably allow people to lose weight on a long-term basis. So why was it that leptin supplementation worked so well in leptin deficiency obesity, but not in more common types of obesity? This leads us to the troubling paradox of leptin resistance. Under normal circumstances, leptin decreases appetite and increases energy expenditure, leading to weight loss. But unlike the cousins at Cambridge who couldn't produce leptin, most people with obesity don't have low levels of leptin. They in fact have high levels of circulating leptin. That's because leptin is produced by fat cells, and leptin levels increase as we accumulate more and more body fat. So leptin resistance is common in obesity, and it means that despite having high levels of leptin circulating in the bloodstream, leptin is unable to produce its full effects. In other words, leptin is not able to fully do its job. So to understand why that occurs, we have to understand how leptin interacts with the brain. The job of leptin is to signal to the brain that it's time to decrease appetite and increase energy expenditure. Leptin binds to leptin receptors, and these are found all over the body. But in the brain, there are particularly high levels in the hypothalamus on specific sites called the ventromedial, the paraventricular, and the arcuate nuclei. It's not necessary to remember the names of these structures. What's more important to remember is that there are two groups of neurons that are necessary for leptin to do its jobs and overall for us to be able to regulate our appetite and energy expenditure. The first type of neuron is called the NPY neuron, living in the arcuate. These are the hunger neurons. They make you feel hungry. The second type of neuron is called a POMC neuron, or pro-opio-melanocortin neuron. Also living in the arcuate, these are the satiety neurons. These make you feel full or satiated. Under normal circumstances, leptin binds to leptin receptors on the surfaces of these neurons, and it suppresses the activity of the NPY neurons, or the hunger neurons, so it suppresses hunger. It activates the POMC neurons, or the fullness or satiety neurons. The POMC neurons then convey a signal downstream by secreting a neurotransmitter called alpha-melanocyte stimulating hormone, or alpha-MSH. The net effect of all of this is to increase energy expenditure and decrease appetite. The effects of leptin are communicated or mediated downstream by activating a part of our nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system. This is a part of the nervous system that conveys the fight or flight response. So if you're sitting in a plane and your seat drops 20 feet because of turbulence and your heart rate goes up, that's the fight or flight or the sympathetic nervous system in action. So because leptin indirectly activates the sympathetic nervous system, its other effects are to increase heart rate, increase blood pressure, to increase thermogenesis by activating brown fat tissue, and also to increase glucose uptake by muscle tissue. So overall, the signal that leptin communicates to the brain is that we have enough energy stored up as fat mass to do some things that require extra energy. So if leptin resistance is common in weight gain and obesity, why is it that we develop leptin resistance in the first place? Well, when a bioactive signal like leptin is chronically elevated, a common response of the body is to downregulate its responsiveness to that signal. That means that more of that same signal will be required to produce the same effect. So when leptin is chronically high, as it is in most cases of obesity, the body makes adjustments, effectively protecting itself against excess leptin-induced weight loss. There are a few different ways that leptin resistance can develop. The first way is called peripheral leptin resistance. So in peripheral leptin resistance, leptin has a hard time getting through from the bloodstream to the brain, and specifically, it has a hard time getting through from the bloodstream through to the fluid that surrounds the brain and the spinal cord called the cerebrospinal fluid, or CSF. So despite having high levels of leptin in the bloodstream, the levels of leptin in the cerebrospinal fluid are relatively lower than they should be in obesity. The reason why, to the best of our knowledge, is likely due to changes in what is called the blood-brain barrier. This barrier normally separates the bloodstream from the brain and the spinal cord to protect the brain and the spinal cord against infections and molecules that could leak through and cause disruption to the central nervous system. Now, there's some evidence currently that the reason why leptin levels are lower in the CSF in obesity than they should be is due to the effect of increased triglycerides on the function of the blood-brain barrier. This is still being worked out, but it is consistent, as we do know that in some cases of metabolic syndrome, there are increased levels of triglycerides. The other type of leptin resistance that can develop is called central leptin resistance, often called cellular leptin resistance. So in central leptin resistance, the leptin receptors that are normally present on the surface of neurons in the hypothalamus are downregulated, meaning that they're decreased in number. Not only that, but the mRNA precursors that supply the blueprint to make leptin receptors are also lower. And the effect of that is that it's going to take more leptin to activate the same number of receptors. But in addition to being decreased in number, the effect of leptin when it binds to its leptin receptors is blunted downstream. So there are two mechanisms at least that are playing a role in central leptin resistance. Now, who gets what type of leptin resistance? Well, there's some evidence that peripheral leptin resistance is more associated with age-associated obesity. This is still being worked out. And there's some data that suggests that chronically elevated levels of fructose intake is associated with central leptin resistance or cellular leptin resistance. This is also still being worked out and is very preliminary, but I will point out that where do many humans get a lot of their fructose in their diets? And the answer is sugar and high fructose corn syrup. Now, is there anything wrong with being leptin resistant? Well, many scientists think that leptin resistance could make it more difficult for people to lose weight. And based on this model, the hypothalamus is effectively undersensing the body fat stores, making it harder to regulate appetite. What might happen if we tried to restore someone's leptin sensitivity or to resensitize them to leptin? This would be the opposite of leptin resistance. And is it even possible to do this? Well, we know that drugs that can resensitize aged animals and animals with diet-induced obesity to leptin result in lower food intake and lower body fat. Now, are there any non-pharmacologic ways that we can improve leptin sensitivity? Well, some data suggests that in animals, healthy eating may be associated with improved leptin sensitivity. We don't have any good data regarding diet and leptin sensitivity in humans. The only direct evidence that we have in humans is that randomized controlled trials show that chronic exercise can lower levels of leptin in the serum or bloodstream in humans. Now, you can look at this one of two different ways. One way of looking at this would be that we need less leptin to do the same job. The other way of looking at this is that perhaps the body is trying to protect itself against exercise-induced weight loss by lowering leptin. The reality is that if we are just looking at human studies, we don't know. So we have to try to look at animal studies to be able to piece together what might be going on. And the animal evidence shows that aerobic and resistance training, or strength training, improve both central and peripheral leptin resistance. It's thought currently, and there's some evidence, that this could be occurring by a couple of different mechanisms. One is that exercise may be able to activate the POMC neurons, or the satiety neurons, and inhibit the NPY neurons, or the hunger neurons. Another way that has some evidence behind it is by improved downstream signaling of leptin receptors. Another mechanism that's under investigation is that perhaps exercise improves inflammation within the hypothalamus, and this is important because hypothalamic inflammation is known to affect neuron signaling. And now we're at the part of the episode where I want to pause, because everything we've talked about so far relates to molecular or functional changes in the hypothalamus. We're now learning that leptin resistance is just the very beginning, just the tip of the iceberg of adverse neurological changes that can result from caloric surpluses and obesity. We now know that even in the earlier stages of obesity, the hypothalamus undergoes not just functional changes, but physical microstructural changes at the cell level. And the concerning part about these changes is that they have a remarkable similarity to the patterns that we see in brain injury. So what are these changes, and what exactly do they mean? Well, within the brain, there are cells that support neurons called glial cells. And one type of glial cell is called a microglia. These are the immune cells of the brain. The microglia are also one of the main cells that respond to the injury of neurons. For example, they're activated in strokes and traumatic brain injury and other forms of stress. So when an area of the brain or neurons is injured, the microglia respond by rapidly extending their cell processes that look like arms and branching out rapidly towards the injury. During this process, if their response is significant enough, they can begin to initiate the formation of what is called a glial scar. Well, we now know, and it's been documented in many different experiments, that excessive caloric intake and diet-induced obesity can trigger a microglial response in the hypothalamus. In fact, in animals, all it takes is a few days of poor diet or energy surplus to induce these hypothalamic inflammatory changes in gliosis. Well, what evidence do we have that this is occurring in humans? The reality is that it's very difficult to look for cellular changes in the brains of living humans. But we know that MRI imaging of the brain in obesity shows signs of hypothalamic scarring in an area of the brain called the medial basal hypothalamus, and this is evidenced by increased T2 relaxation time. We also know that brain dissections after people have died show microgliosis associated with obesity. So there is decent human evidence that this is occurring as well. So these changes, are they problematic, or are they maladaptive, or is the brain trying to spare itself and protect itself against something even worse? Well, if we're being honest with ourselves, the data are not completely in, and so we can't know for sure. But all the signs at this point are pointing towards this microglial and inflammatory response being rather unhelpful. Not only because it may disrupt appetite regulation and energy balance, but it also seems to alter neuronal signaling in the hypothalamus and may lead to worsened leptin resistance. We also don't know how reversible these changes are, especially the microglial response. So if we're concerned that hypothalamic inflammation and gliosis is rather unhelpful in diet-induced obesity, we have to ask the question of why and how this occurs. Well, first, we don't know for sure that the inflammatory response is due to obesity alone, per se. It may be the case, in fact, that along the way towards developing obesity, that overnutrition alone is sufficient to produce these changes. It also may be the case that these changes are induced by fluctuation in levels of circulating fatty acids, and we'll get into that. What we do know is that there are at least a few ways that we can induce the hypothalamic inflammatory response. One way of doing this is by overnutrition with high amounts of carbohydrates and saturated fatty acids, and in particular, long-chain saturated fatty acids. These tend to be found more highly in animal fats, and these activate a pro-inflammatory pathway called the NF-kappa-B pathway, and in turn leads to increased inflammatory cytokines in the recruitment of cells like macrophages and monocytes that help to sustain the inflammation, and stress on a part of the cell called the endoplasmic reticulum. This is the protein packaging factory of the cell. Well, how do we know that it's not just an association that we're seeing with feeding? Well, scientists have infused different nutritional substances like fatty acids and sugars into the ventricles, or the fluid reservoirs, in areas near the hypothalamus, and we see the same effects. Meaning that when we mimic overnutrition with these substances, we still get the same result of hypothalamic inflammation. Now, paradoxically, we also know that another way to induce these changes is by inducing rapid weight loss. And that's potentially because when an organism rapidly loses weight, they have increased levels of free fatty acids during that time. Now, coincidentally, there is another condition where we see increased levels of free fatty acids in addition to rapid weight loss, and that is obesity and metabolic syndrome. So this may explain some of the association of both of these conditions with hypothalamic inflammation. Now, based on the very preliminary data that we have today, it looks like some fatty acids might generate more or less of an inflammatory response in the hypothalamus when they're compared with long-chain saturated fatty acids, or animal fats. So olive oil, for example, contains higher amounts of monounsaturated fats. And for whatever reason, this doesn't seem to be producing as much of an inflammatory response in the hypothalamus compared to those long-chain saturated fatty acids. With regard to coconut oil, this seems to be somewhere in the middle, but we have very weak data on this right now, so this could easily change. Now, some scientists argue, quite intriguingly, that it's in fact the combined consumption of fat and sugar, rather than fat alone, that's responsible for the gliosis response in the hypothalamus. And they argue that this is due to the presence and formation of what are called advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. So AGEs are compounds that are created effectively accidentally by modifying our native biomolecules with various types of sugars. So one of the proposed mechanisms is that microglia are able to sense and respond to the presence of AGEs, which activate them and then trigger this response. Now, what do we know about reversing hypothalamic inflammation? Well, similar to what we talked about with leptin resistance, there is a severe lack of human studies. So everything I'm about to mention is very much preliminary and in the animal stages of testing and investigation. But based upon what we know from these studies in animals, one of the more promising candidates for reversing hypothalamic inflammation at the present is in fact bariatric surgery. It's also been shown that exercise can protect against a lot of these changes, and that hypothalamic gliosis can be reversed, at least in animals, by returning to a healthy diet. This was shown very nicely in a study that I'll link to over at the website at nicksterling.com. Some other compounds and agents that are under investigation are showing some promise for improving hypothalamic inflammation are resolvins. These are compounds that are derived from omega-3 fatty acids and may be able to stimulate the resolution of inflammation. Adiponectin is another candidate. This helps with insulin sensitivity. Other candidates include inhibitors of inflammatory pathways and agents that alleviate endoplasmic reticular stress. So we've gone over a lot of information in this episode. It's become very clear today that the brain has been a neglected part of the stories of obesity and metabolic syndrome. This is an area that we're just starting to understand. But what can we take away from the evidence that we have so far? Well, the first takeaway is that since inflammatory and cell brain changes seem to occur relatively early in the course of obesity, and since they may make it even more difficult to lose weight, this is generally something that we want to avoid if we can, and we want to avoid it worsening if we can. In mice, these changes develop in as little as a few days, and on a human timescale, they may occur over a different time frame. We don't know yet. I can tell you what I do, and none of this is nutritional or medical advice, but if I've indulged in an excessive or unhealthy eating pattern for a meal, I make sure that the next few meals are healthy. If I've been undisciplined for an entire day, like around the holidays, I make sure that the next few days are healthy. The second takeaway is that although all of the brain changes that we've discussed in this episode are going to make it easier or harder for us to gain or lose weight, we are more than our hypothalami. Our lower brain structures are there to guide our default behaviors, not to make decisions for us. And this brings us to our third takeaway, which is that the sooner someone can become healthy and adopt a healthy lifestyle, the better. Prevention is always the best by healthy eating and exercise, but if you're someone who has struggled with weight gain for some time or struggled to lose weight, it isn't too late, and it's always important to start where you are. We're going to talk about losing weight and keeping it off in a future episode. I also want to mention that there are new pharmacologic tools that are becoming available over recent years, so don't be afraid to reach out to your doctor because he or she can help you when you run into difficulty. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to support this channel, the very best way to do that is to hit the subscribe button and the like button. Share these videos with your friends. Please also head over to nicksterling.com where you can find the sign up for the newsletter. You can find me on all the major platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Spotify, with the ID SterlingMDPhD. So with that, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. This podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or any other healthcare professional services. The content of this podcast is not medical advice and should not be interpreted as medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. You should not attempt to implement any of the topics or concepts discussed on this podcast without the direct approval and supervision of your own physician. This podcast should not take precedence over the information provided to you by your healthcare provider or official public health sources. Listeners should not delay obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have. The use or non-use of the information provided in this podcast or any associated or linked materials is exclusively at the user's own risk. Please visit nicksterling.com for relevant disclosures and full terms of use.